welcome to the second episode of Tomorrow Never Knows. I am Charlotte Lydia Riley, and this is...
I'm Emma London, and this is the episode, the second of the two-parter episode about women's bodies. I have a feeling that this might be a running theme, Charlotte.
Yes.
But we're attempting to keep it to two episodes for now, but if anyone has any ideas or any thoughts or wants to participate, you can always get in touch with us.
Yeah, tweet us. Send us tweets.
Facebook comments.
Ooh.
Ooh, exciting. Today we're going to continue with women's bodies, but we're going to be talking more about imagery of women, I suppose. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about fashion. I'm going to get you to talk about selfies. I think this is a generational gap we have, Charlotte. You're 3 years younger than me and you can do selfies. I can't really do them. They don't agree with me. I don't agree with them. Well, I quite like them and there's other people's faces in them. But anyway, so the reason this is an interesting topic for both of us is that we work on, well, I suppose our research comes into this on women in politics.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the images we have selected for the kind of general PR plugging bit of this podcast is from InStyle, I think in 2013 or 14.
Mm-hmm.
They did like a gradient of Hillary Clinton and her incredibly colourful pantsuits.
Yes.
Which are really quite significant. I think there is now a briefly in the first episode I talked mm-hmm. about the fact that female politicians often didn't know what to wear
mm-hmm.
when they first entered parliament. Many of them entered in very small numbers, mm-hmm. so there would be like 3 or 4, maybe 5, and then women who become cabinet ministers also have the issue of trying to work out what to wear, what's appropriate, how do yeah. you act. And Hillary Clinton is one of quite a number of female politicians who've solved the conundrum by going for the pantsuit. I mean, the other really famous wearer is Angela Merkel.
Yes, who also has, you can also see a gradient of Angela Merkel pantsuits.
Mm.
Although I feel like, compared to Hillary, and this is obviously very ideologically charged, I feel like Merkel re-wears her pantsuits more frequently.
I also feel that they're more pastel-y.
Yes, they are definitely more pastel. Definitely. But I think she also has, you know, a series of hard-working trouser suits or pantsuits that she sort of repeats. Whereas I feel like Hillary, who must be degrees richer than Merkel, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, has a different type of image. She has a series of new ones, I think.
And a supposedly different type of politics as well.
I mean, theoretically
Merkel, yeah, politics, Merkel yeah. is a Christian Democrat.
Yes.
Who grew up in East Germany with all of what that entails.
Mm-hmm.
Hillary Clinton is, I don't actually know very much about her background, but I presume that she's fairly middle class privileged.
Yes, yeah, she is.
And is supposedly, I mean, I'm flinching now, but I was about to say more radical, but I don't know if that's true. Progressive is maybe a better yeah. word for it.
So, I mean, I think for both of them, it's...
Does that mean that she's happier to stand out, maybe? Or that she's more interested in standing out?
Yeah, so something to do with... I also think, you know, it's a different sort of image, isn't it? Because Merkel is, one, actually a leader,
Oh, true.
Merkel is actually in power.
Mm.
And our images of Merkel are often, you know, her surrounded by male politicians, particularly in international forum. So sort of things like the G8.
Oh, yeah.
She's often the only woman. Mm. And so the kind of muted colours maybe are different. I mean, I'm probably overreaching here. She probably just likes pastels.
Yeah.
But, you know, the kind of muted colours aren't... Whereas for Hillary, sort of wanting to stand out, wearing bright reds and very bright colours, I think might be...
Yeah.
I always forget that in America, the red and the blue were the other way around.
Yeah.
So I was just about to say, oh, maybe she's wearing red as a kind of political allegiance, but of course it's blue.
She's not a Republican.
Color.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
My research on some of Labour's women, which I know that you have done quite a bit of research on as well. Obviously, red as a woman's colour in the Labour Party comes up quite a bit. So there's quite a famous picture of Tony Blair's first cabinet, and Margaret Beckett is wearing red. Harriet Harman has red. So this sort of imagery. Mary Agnes Hamilton, who was an MP in 1929, wore red shoes.
Oh, okay.
To the House of Commons, but she wore red shoes because all of the male Labour Party MPs at that point wore a red tie.
Oh, really?
And so she didn't have that available to her, and so she used to wear red shoes.
Oh, interesting.
Which used to lead to sort of lewd comments, because red shoes in Britain are associated with sex workers. Mm. And then, because I think the thing about the pantsuit is it's a uniform, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a good idea to adopt a uniform. And it's very, you know, it's... Well, actually, neither Hillary nor Merkel's colour choices, that you know, they're very feminine, they're bright colours or pastel colours.
Mm.
But a pantsuit is trousers.
Yeah.
You're wearing trousers in the workplace rather than a skirt.
Mm.
I think in Laura Beers's autobiography of Ellen Wilkinson.
Biography.
Yeah. Laura Beers's biography of Ellen Wilkinson.
I have to credit properly.
I think it's in her book where she talks about Ellen Wilkinson going up into the gallery to look down on the House of Commons at one point, and then deciding that she would start wearing below-the-knee skirts again rather than the shorter, more fashionable skirt, because when viewed from the gallery, women sitting in these shorter skirts looked kind of ungainly, you could see.
Oh, interesting.
It was sort of an unflattering angle to be depicted in a shorter skirt, and so she went back to wearing these kind of more old-fashioned, I guess what we call a midi skirt now.
Yeah, because that's interesting, because that kind of fashion then continued for a while afterwards. Mm. I know that there were politicians who came in later. I know Betty Boothroyd found it very annoying that there was a kind of uniform for women MPs.
Yeah.
When she came into Parliament in 1973 and was a very sort of feminine, fashionable woman. And she had comments by other... I don't know if she overheard them or someone made them actually to her, but from other women MPs saying that she wasn't really dressing appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she kind of didn't enjoy the old fashion. What I think is interesting about the pantsuits is that, first of all, when you see those gradients, you realise just how many outfits, particularly Hillary Clinton, has, right?
Yes.
But also that they are so colour coordinated.
Yes.
I have never, I mean, apart from wearing all black, which I'm sure I do as a Scandinavian quite mm-hmm. often without thinking, I don't think I would ever feel very comfortable wearing head to toe green or yellow or red.
It's a really block colour dressing. And like a single block colour as well, so just doing red head to toe. It's a really powerful statement, but it's not... I would feel not a particularly flattering.
No,
It does seem really funny. It makes it, to me, feel even more like a uniform, because it reminds me of, you know, when you see kind of school children in some sort of hideous bottle green uniform and they've got a bottle green blazer and bottle green trousers, or, you know, a green sweater and skirt.
Mm.
And now, you know, when I went to school... I went to a comprehensive and it didn't have that type of uniform, but we had a kind of royal blue sweater and grey skirt, so it wasn't sort of so it's not so identifiably uniform in the same way. Although I still feel uncomfortable putting those colours together, because I still feel like I'm in a school uniform. And wearing a solid colour head to toe to me just feels like you're at a private school and you're wearing some sort of ridiculous.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It is obviously a uniform, and it has become... There is... in Harriet Harman's autobiography,
mm-hmm.
there is a... she talks about the way that they all dressed in the 90s. The sort of shorter jackets that they all had, colourful jackets. And then that was actually a PR strategy. They'd all kind of learnt it individually, but it was... They had been taught, or they had realised... obviously taught by other women, that it was good for them to stand out instead of blending into the background.
That's
so when
thing.
You see that image of all the women in Labour MPs, women MPs, surrounded by Tony Blair, which is another issue. Harriet Harman didn't really want Tony Blair there, but didn't really feel like she could say no to the very popularly elected PM.
I like how you said surrounded by Tony Blair as well, not surrounding Tony Blair.
Oh God, yeah, no.
But I feel like that's a very telling telling slip, that all of the Blair babes are surrounded by Tony Blair.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably how they felt as well. If Harry's autobiography is anything to go by, she wasn't very pleased about that. But yeah, it is a uniform.
Mm-hmm.
It is And it, that gives maybe a bit of protection as well. I think part of it is that it means that you know what to wear. It's easier to make the decision.
Yeah.
And you sort your wardrobe out to fit it. But it's also, you know, they create that code themselves by doing it. I gave a paper in June, I think, at a symposium on homosociality arranged by Rachel Moss in Oxford, where I showed images of the Labour MPs in Blair's first parliament. I'm not going to call them Blair babes. and Hillary Clinton. And there were comments towards the end about whether that's good, whether it's something that stifles women. Mm-hmm. So that generation of women often felt like it was a liberation in a way, that it kind of took the choices away from them. Their choice had been made. This is how it works. This is how it looks. Mm-hmm. And that was appropriate and like headache over. But for younger generations of women, the people following them, it might not necessarily be as true. So whereas we now see Merkel stand out in photo calls for big government meetings or like international organizational meetings and stuff, it might put other women off running for similar things because they don't fancy that look.
I think the thing that's really funny about it as well is that the reason that women in Harriet Harman's group of women, the reason they're thinking so much about clothes is because they're a small minority, right? And so the eye is on them. But also the other reason they're thinking about it is because men literally do have a uniform. Men wear a suit. All male MPs wear a suit. And there's quite a strict dress code in the British House of Commons. Mm. And, you know, male MPs can't wear jeans. In the House of Commons, there's a really strict dress code, so men do wear a suit, so men have a uniform, and so of course, you know, there is a spectrum, a gradient of suits, from the very baggy, elephantine, unflattering, egg-stained tie, sweat-stained shirt.
Or necks.
Yes, or like the sort of very, you know, very unflattering suit, through to the sort of, you know, Savile Row, tailored, beautiful, Prince of Wales check or something. You know, of course you can be flamboyant and wear a suit. But, you know, for men, there is most of the decision is taken away. They decide what tie to wear. Or they decide maybe what colour shirt to wear. And so part of the reason why women are thinking about it in that way, in that particular context, is because men literally do have a uniform. And so in a way, you know, the fact that women even have to have a conversation about it or make a decision about it is itself very gendered. And it's funny because I think in a way, when, you know, I said in the previous episode that there are, for me, similarities between women in academia and women in politics, and there are similar ideas about, you know, what do you wear as a female academic? And it's slightly different in academia because there is this kind of sense of often a sort of performative scruffiness among a lot of men in academia, which sort of symbolises that they are too wrapped up in the intellectual world to think about their appearance, and, you know, and the very stereotypical idea of the professor with kind of, you know, mad hair and an unironed shirt and a ridiculous holy jumper and, you know, terrible trousers that don't fit him because he's just, you know, come up with a theorem or something. He's going to win the Nobel Prize. And firstly, it's so much more difficult to get away with that type of scruffiness if you are a woman. In an academia in particular, you know, because people don't tend to dress that smartly, certainly not in British academia. There's a real difference actually with American academia, where people do dress almost as if they're in the business world often. But because people don't dress smartly, it's also that thing for women, I think, where you sort of don't quite know which bits of your wardrobe match up against that level of smartness.
Yeah, and it's interesting as well because different universities have different thinking and ideas about that as well. Because I've worked across a lot of the universities that are based in London. I think there are two that I haven't worked for. And I know I did my PhD at Birkbeck, where I also taught, and they actually recommend that you dress down because the student body is one that well, you teach in the evenings to start with, so people will have come from their own jobs.
Mm-hmm.
I had students who came off building sites mm-hmm. to go and do a history degree in the evening with me. And if I'd been there in, I don't know, some sort of cocktail dress or something, a sort of really smart business attire that I don't own, that would maybe have limited the student-tutor interaction. But I sort of, you know, I'm one of these people. So we all read that academic evaluations are biased against women and that we're not perceived as being as senior or intellectual or whatever. I mean, we don't gain the same amount of credit for the work that we do mm-hmm. in general. And that one way of dealing with that is to dress more senior or dress more properly. I feel like I'm actually physically unable to do that. I don't mean that to say that I go to teach in clothes with holes in them, at least mm-hmm. not on purpose. Who knows what happens on the way to work? But I generally feel like, and this is maybe a problem that I have, that I'm just over it. I've chosen not to do that. And I also have had now, over the past 2 years, that I have taught either pregnant or with a young child mm-hmm. and a body that doesn't necessarily fit into the pre-pregnancy clothes and stuff. And I'm not going to go and buy a new wardrobe just because I'm teaching a few hours a week. Mm-hmm. So I've basically gone with the, I'm going to wear what I can wear, and if anyone has an issue with it, they're going to have to tell me. But so far no one has. I try to wear sort of proper shoes. Because I think if you're wearing
a pair of proper shoes, is quite
if you wear proper shoes, you get away with a lot. I also have, you know, I tend to wear maybe a smarter jacket mm-hmm. on first meeting the students. That's not so much to leave an impression about my suitability as a tutor on them, but more kind of to show perhaps that I take it fairly seriously. And
I think it's funny because if I'm going to something professionally when I know men will be in suits, Which ranges from things that are really quite smart to things that are kind of smart casual, I guess. Men wear suits in lots of different occasions. Actually, I don't find that too difficult. Like, I don't have a suit. I did have a suit a long time ago in my early 20s, but I didn't wear it very much. And I walked to interviews, and I haven't had a suit for a long time. But I have a number of kind of smart dresses that I would wear. I don't wear trousers very often. I wear skinny jeans, sometimes I wear leggings sometimes, but I tend to wear skirts and dresses, and so I have a number of smart dresses that I can put, you know, a jacket over or something, and I feel perfectly fine. And obviously, you know, I have things I could wear to a black tie event or whatever. But the thing I find quite difficult sometimes is the bit where the sort of slightly below a suit level for men, where they might be wearing sort of shirt and trousers or something.
Oh, yeah, and shirt and jeans.
Oh, yeah, shirt and jeans. I don't like a shirt and jeans.
It's not a good look, but what is the equivalent for women?
Well, so, I mean, you could wear a shirt and jeans, I suppose. But I
would just feel like I was some sort of 1980s magazine, though. But
which is not a bad look. But I think for me as well, like I used to, because I started teaching in universities when I was 23.
Oh, okay.
That would have been, I think, I would have been 24. I think I started teaching undergraduates when I was 24. So there were only, you know, at most 2 or 3 years between me and the students I was teaching. And so obviously when I started doing that, I was quite acutely aware that I didn't necessarily have a huge amount of natural authority in the classroom as a young woman teaching in an elite institution. And so I would dress... What I thought of at the time as relatively smartly, I thought I was dressing smartly. Actually, now in hindsight, I'm not sure how smart I was. but I thought I was dressing smartly, and that was a big deal to me. And I would never, ever have worn jeans or trainers to teach. And my first kind of proper job at the University of York, I had a kind of teaching uniform that was incredibly boring and I disliked. I disliked most of the things that I wore. I wore a pencil skirt and things, which again, I've got nothing against a pencil skirt, but I wore...
I
love a pencil skirt, but I wore a particularly boring pencil skirt with boring tops, and you know, I sort of resented
it. Didn't make you happy.
It did not make me happy. And then it was really striking to me that sort of men at similar stage in their career, a similar age, would wear hoodies and jeans to teach. Or in the summer might wear shorts,
mm.
which I would never do still now. I don't think I'd ever wear shorts. I mean, partly because my shorts are different to the shorts that men wear, but...
Yeah, women's shorts tend to be a bit shorter.
My shorts are just a lot shorter. It would be inappropriate, but... And actually, recently, I've become a lot more relaxed. I think I'm more confident in my authority.
Mm.
But also, I started to realise that one of the benefits of an academic career is that you don't have to wear horrible clothes you don't like to work. So I started to wear more things that I actually like.
So the thing is, I started teaching when I was in my 30s because mm-hmm. I did my PhD after already having worked full-time as a journalist for 5 or 6 years. So I have always had the age.
Mm-hmm. You've always had age on your side.
Always had the age benefits, which is a weird way to think of it. And I don't think I've ever been, perhaps like Birkbeck, where students tend to be of all ages. I think that's probably the only place I've been mistaken for a student.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps that's why I have always been getting away with, or at least allowing myself to get away with wearing whatever I fancy wearing in the classroom. So welcome to being above the age of 30, Charlotte.
Yes.
It's very good here.
I feel like a grown up. There's a really good poem. I feel like all I do is say, there's a poem that is relevant to this experience, but by a woman called Susan Harlan, who writes great poetry about academia. And it's called Poem on a Male Colleague's Thoughts on My Clothing. And it's, you really don't need to dress up, you know. I mean, I don't worry about that sort of thing. And it just, that kind of, it's very, very striking, I think, in academia and in lots of fields where there's not a set dress code.
Mm.
That men, not only do men not dress up, but they also don't think about it or ever consider that their clothes might be a feature in a way that they are considered professionally. It's just not something that occurs to them.
Yeah.
And it is absolutely something that occurs to all of the women I know. And all of the women I know in academia are sort of well put together. They think about their outfits, they think about their clothes, they have, you know, haircuts and things. They dress appropriately, but in a way that, you know, they clearly think about how they dress.
Mm.
And the men don't necessarily. Some of them do, some of them don't. And I don't think it's a bad thing to care about how you put yourself together. I don't think it's a bad thing to care about clothes. Sometimes I wonder if it would be better if men cared more rather than women cared less, which is, I don't know, not necessarily something that other people in academia would agree with, I think.
But how would they care more?
I don't know, this makes me sound like terribly fascistic. I think I just, I want everyone to wear clean clothes to work. I want everyone to,
yeah,
you know.
There's a hygiene aspect, I suppose.
I think there's a sort of self-care
mm.
in caring about your appearance, but there's also a sort of courtesy
yeah.
in dressing appropriately for the workplace, which, again, oh God, makes me sound like something out of the 1950s.
No, but I think you're right, and I think maybe that's kind of coming back into how women dress for being politicians and mm-hmm. how that varies throughout the ages. It's we do have uniforms.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of, in a way, easier for a student as well if it's easier to spot us.
Yes, exactly.
In, you know, there are more of them than there are teachers.
This also just, I mean, nothing, I get so angry when I see Boris Johnson in a crumpled shirt with his ridiculous hair.
Oh, and I'm actually shuddering now. I don't know if you can hear it on the recording, but it's happening.
There is a privilege in being able to dress however you want. And being able to adopt a clownish persona and not take yourself seriously and still be taken seriously.
Yeah.
And for women to be taken seriously in the public arena, they have to demonstrate that they take themselves seriously first.
Mm.
And
that looks in a specific way in our business.
Exactly.
Yeah. I remember reading a blog by someone who I think might be a Swedish journalist who lives in London, I can't remember, who lived in Hackney, I think, and her neighbour had, like, gold teeth. And she was like, oh, that's so cool, I want to get gold teeth. And her neighbour was like, no, you shouldn't, because people judge you
mm-hmm.
for having, you look like, you know, like you're into crime, basically. And you shouldn't. And she all of a sudden realised, so she being of a middle-class background with a middle-class profession, a very comfortable freelancing life,
mm-hmm.
she gets away with,
yeah,
you know, buying into a certain look that other people can't, because yes. they would then find doors shut in their face when they ring the doorbell.
Exactly. There is a privilege to being able to act in a way that is socially deemed unprofessional and still be considered professional.
And I suppose my privilege in deciding what I want to wear to teach, which might make it sound as though I wear ridiculous things. I tend not to, I think.
Can I just say, I think you always look quite smart.
Yeah, no, but you might also be the only person to say that, Charlotte. But I certainly haven't had a haircut for about 7 months. But I think that is the privilege of doing a PhD later in life, actually. I've never had to set myself apart from my students. It's obvious to both me and them when I walk into a classroom that I know more in that particular topic. On that particular topic, I have read more than they have, even though they might have swatted up insanely before that lesson. That doesn't mean that they don't know a lot about other stuff that I have absolutely no clue about, including maybe what's appropriate to wear to the office. But yes. You know,
it's also funny because the pantsuit, going back to the idea of the pantsuit, obviously, you know, we pointed out that it's trousers. So it's women dressing, you know, the pantsuits themselves, Hillary Clinton's pantsuits are very feminine, but, you know, trousers are unisex and masculine. They're not feminine, you know, itself inherently feminine.
A unisex uniform also always includes trousers. It's never a unisex skirt.
Androgynous fashion is always leans masculine. Always. Androgynous fashion is never... Yeah, it's never men in dresses. It's always, you know, female models with high cheekbones and short hair. That androgyny is always... Androgyny tends to be androcentric. But it's interesting, I think, women in the public eye who have... So I write a lot about Barbara Castle, and I research Barbara Castle, and who is a Labour MP in the 1960s through until the 21st century. But that her... her uniform was the pussy bow blouse.
Can we just point out here that predates Margaret Thatcher's uniform?
It absolutely does.
And I would be one of maybe many to say that Margaret Thatcher's uniform is partly modelled on Barbara Castle's.
It absolutely is.
So Barbara Castle was one of the most senior women ever to hold cabinet offices.
Yeah.
She's appointed several times.
Yes, she becomes a Minister for Overseas Development in 1964, moves to Minister of Transport, she's in Home and Pensions. She's the fourth ever female cabinet minister, I think. And she's very senior there. For a long time,
For a long time, she's the only woman.
Yes, and there is, you know, in the 1960s and 70s, you find a lot of discourse about her being a potential first female prime minister. Her career is slightly destroyed within the Labour Party with the In Place of Strife booklet, which is a pamphlet about how to...
I would argue completely destroyed.
Completely destroyed.
But there we are.
A pamphlet about managing trade unions in Britain.
She was known for being up very much on the very left wing of the party until she is in charge of this white paper, which...
She's seen as selling herself out.
Which basically is a blueprint for how to limit trade union influence. Yeah. But she was also a very feminine woman.
Very. She wears makeup. She has red hair, which she cares about very much. So the morning when she's appointed to be Minister of Overseas Development, she hasn't washed her hair. I think she has her hair set, and she hasn't. So she has to wear a hat to go to Downing Street. And this is mentioned in her diaries. When In Place of Strife comes out and is so controversial, she deals with this by going and buying three new dresses. She's very, very feminine. And, you know, she talks on and off in her memoirs and things like this about using your feminine power or being a politician and using... You know, which is all quite problematic in terms of...
She was very flirtatious.
She's very flirtatious, which I very much enjoy when reading about her. And I think, you know, is a really human and interesting aspect of her personality. But certainly the way she talks about sort of women having particularly feminine powers and things like this is obviously kind of problematic if you're thinking about men and women being
in politics. She was born in 1912.
Yes,
that's
exactly.
Maybe something to point out as
she's of a different generation.
She's very much of a very different generation.
But she, you know, she's always very well put together. She cares a lot about her appearance. When she is a minister, her hair appointments are in her ministerial diary. Every Friday she has a shampoo and set and has her hair blow-dried. And it's interesting to me because most women in the public eye who adopt a uniform don't adopt an overtly feminine uniform. It's quite rare. With notable exceptions, but, you know, particularly in politics, it's quite rare for women to wear, you know, lots of floral prints or dresses, or, you know, to really make a big deal of that.
Should we maybe mention Theresa May
here? Yeah.
Because we're recording this the day after Theresa May's conference speech, which obviously we can talk a lot about, but she was particularly wearing a Frida Kahlo bracelet.
Yeah. And this, I find this particularly interesting because Theresa May is someone who has always understood the power of personal image. At her first Conservative Party conference, when she gives a speech as Home Secretary, she wears kitten heels that are leopard print. She's been, you know, she's worn trousers that are thousands of pounds worth of leather trousers. Although at the time, you know, I'm no defender of Theresa May, but I'm sure David Cameron's suits cost more than those trousers did. I'm sure his watch cost more than those trousers did. But, you know, women's outfits are up for grabs in a way that men's aren't. And, she, you know, she's always been very image conscious. She clearly likes clothes and cares about clothes, and this is part of how she puts herself together, which, you know, great, fine, you know, it's either you want to do that or you don't want to do that, it's up to you. But so the wearing of a Frida Kahlo bracelet, you know, a noted communist who was Trotsky's lover.
Yeah, I mean, she's not just any communist, she's
no.
I don't know. It's a little bit like Madeleine Albright, who, as US Foreign Secretary, was well known for wearing brooches that conveyed a message.
Mm-hmm.
So she would be wearing like a double-headed snake if she was in negotiations where someone was being less than forthcoming. And I don't know. Is Theresa May trying to tell her something? Because does she know? Surely she knows, right? You can't know anything about Frida Kahlo without knowing that she's a Mexican communist with, you know, very well known and important connection to Trotsky after he flees the Soviet Union before
and
the
very
murder of him.
Politics generally, and I feel like with other people, maybe I would say, of course, it's not, you know, you can just wear things.
Mm.
You know, people can just wear things and not be sending a message. And, you know, with other women, I would point out that we don't pore over men's clothes in the same way. And this is, you know, part of the problem of being a woman in the public eye. But with Theresa May, who does know about how important clothes are and she does care about her image, I don't understand it. And Bim Adjawumni on Twitter said that this was a kind of, which I think is a good point. She said, you know, this Theresa May wearing a Frida Kahlo bracelet is the kind of old Hillary Clinton feminist, this kind of liberal feminism that just meaninglessly supports all women without thinking about their politics. The idea that, for example, Theresa May has also been photographed wearing a This Is What a Feminist Looks Like t-shirt.
Oh, yeah.
When she was Home Secretary in charge of Yarl's Wood.
Yeah.
Of course.
For anyone who doesn't know Giles Wood, it's where women are locked up waiting for deportation out of the British Isles.
Yes, women and children.
It's a very well-publicised, horrendous prison regime in there.
Yeah. In which sexual abuse has been rife and has been identified by a series of reports.
And self-harm.
Yes.
As well. I mean, it's a problematic institution. It's a problematic thing to be in charge of and not do anything about as Home Secretary.
But to claim that you're a feminist whilst being in charge of that, you know, and I think Bim is absolutely right that on one hand, what's being conveyed with this image is this kind of very unproblematized idea that sort of women, yay, feminism. But I sort of believe that Theresa May is maybe slightly beyond that in the way that she uses kind of signs and symbols, and so I find it really, really confusing. I did also try to think, what would be an equivalent for a man, because I just couldn't, I mean, one, you know, of course, but like as a lapel pin, say, and I was thinking, you know, is it like, you know, David Cameron wearing a lapel pin of Trotsky, or, you know, like, what is the equivalent to wearing a bracelet with Frida Kahlo's face on it?
I don't know.
It's so hard to, you know, does she, and why would you be wearing a bracelet? I know it seemed like quite a pretty bracelet. But yeah, it was such a...
I could quite happily wear it.
Well, exactly.
We were going to talk about selfies as a feminist practice. We were running out of time.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a good place to go from Frida Kahlo, who was obviously very big on self-portraits.
Big on
and
selfie.
It's her most famous paintings are all with her image on them. So shall we do a quick bit of that? But can we maybe ask listeners if they have ideas about why Theresa May was wearing Frida Kahlo bracelets?
If you think you know, then tell us.
We're crowdsourcing. But yes, selfies as a feminist practice.
So selfies as feminist practice, which is a hashtag that I like to attach to my selfies, was actually started by the poet Bridget Minimore. And she has kind of used this hashtag on Twitter, I think partly sometimes tongue-in-cheek and partly not tongue-in-cheek. I am fully behind it. I find selfies really empowering. I also spend quite a lot of time commuting by train. and so I find also selfies enormously diverting and interesting on my very long and boring Southwest train journey.
How are they empowering?
I think that as somebody who, I think, like, almost every 32-year-old woman in this country, I spent my teenage years mired in self-doubt and self-loathing of my image, as I think, you know, most teenage girls realistically probably do.
Mm.
And I spent a long time hating photographs and hating photographs of myself, while secretly wanting to see photographs of myself, because teenage girls are nothing if not both kind of hypocritical and also self-obsessed. That's just what it's like to be a teenager.
Well, you want to see if your worst suspicions are confirmed.
Exactly.
And then maybe you've all of a sudden turned into a swan.
Yes, exactly. Maybe you're going to be beautiful and then, you know. And I just find the idea of, you know, I think Instagram is interesting because it's a social media platform that's dominated by women in the same way that Pinterest is. It's a space that I overwhelmingly find women's voices on. I follow a few men that I know personally, but I follow a lot of women I don't know personally, and then female friends. And although I do also have male friends who do take selfies and who post selfies to Instagram, but I find it empowering to have kind of control over being able to publish and produce images of myself that I don't hate. And I also find a kind of empowerment in being able to proclaim to other people, this is a picture of myself that I don't hate, this is a picture of myself that I like. And particularly, and this is where it gets slightly murkier, particularly because on Instagram I can take 40 selfies and find one I like and then apply a series of filters that make it flattering. So I'm essentially kind of airbrushing and photoshopping an image of myself. But there is something about presenting a picture to people and saying, this is a picture of me that I like, and then having this kind of affirmation that I posted a photograph of myself in I posted a selfie that I had taken in a mirror in a lift at the Bodleian Library of myself kind of going to work, and I got loads of really nice comments from all of my friends saying how lovely I looked and how nice I had a leopard print skirt on, which I really like, and they all said I looked great and my outfit was brilliant, and it was nice. It's a nice thing to happen, you know.
Yeah, maybe I should try it. If anyone's been on our website, you might have seen that the photos we have of ourselves, Charlotte's facing the camera and I'm looking away from it. So maybe I just need to practice. I really like selfies of other women and I'm a big fan of the whole idea, but I really struggle. I feel like it's so self-indulgent when I do it with myself. I always throw away the drafts with the 15,000 filters on them. But maybe I should persevere.
You have to get
I also
into
feel
it.
Like I'm now getting to the stage where lots of people do it and I haven't done it. And now that I meet people, maybe they think I look like I did when I was 28 and they will think I look so old in comparison. Whereas the people who I haven't seen for those years, but who keep posting photos of themselves, I've sort of seen age in real time. So yeah. It's like, okay, that's
I think it's also
is
like,
that a good reason to do selfies? Possibly not.
So people don't think they're that age. I think it's good because it normalises, like on a very basic level, it normalises the image of yourself to yourself. Like you just know what you look like. If you take lots of pictures of yourself, which I do,
yeah,
I know what my face looks like.
Yeah,
I
don't really.
And it just sort of there's something. Which I think a lot of men would listen to this and just be completely baffled by the idea that either that you wouldn't know what your own face looks like or that it would be a source of anxiety to you.
Particularly seeing as they probably look at us when we look at ourselves in the mirror applying makeup.
Yeah.
But shall we leave that for another episode? Because I think we're running out of time. But we need to do what our running theme of what we have read, listened to, or have other things to recommend. And we were going to recommend other podcasts today.
Yeah. Yes.
What have you got?
So my favourite podcast at the moment, which I have, if anyone follows me on Twitter, will have seen me recommending over and over again anyway, is Double Love, which is a podcast about the Sweet Valley High books.
Yeah.
Which is... I mean, it's a hilarious podcast anyway. It's really, even if you've never read the books, it's really funny. They're recapping the books from beginning to end, so I think they've now up to maybe the fourth book. But it's really great if you did read them, because these books are hashtag problematic. They are. They have a lot of problems. And it's really interesting to hear women, adult women now, talking about them. And the one that I listened to most recently was an episode... which talks about a book in which the main storyline is essentially about a girl with an eating disorder, but in the book it is not presented as an eating disorder.
It's incredibly fat shaming. It has a very, very weird attitude to dieting, extreme dieting as self-improvement, yes, and a sort absolutely. Of I'm gonna show them type yes. of scenarios, which I thought might explain, you know, a few problematic issues that people around me suffered
exactly
when we were in teens. It's a sort of as a blueprint for how to deal with problems in your life. It's a very bad example, but it's an extremely hilarious and engaging
really good
podcast.
It's excellent.
My recommendation is the one that Ed Miliband does. Things can only get better. No, isn't it called Reasons to be Cheerful? It is. I haven't listened to all of the episodes. I think there are three as we record this. I think there are three. There might be four. It's very funny. It's within the first 10 minutes of the first ever episode. Ed talks about falling on his face when he's out jogging, and the comment that a member of the public made as he was lying on the ground, which isn't maybe what is the most appropriate comment for someone who's just fallen over in front of you. And he also talks about making his wife a cake for her birthday. So it's I'm never really going to be able to forgive Ed for the immigrant mug in the election campaign, but he is proving himself to be a thoroughly funny and engaging person. It's a good podcast. There's a reason to be cheerful, if nothing else. So next time we're going to be talking about illnesses and women's
Next time we're going to be talking about women and work.
Women and work, that's it. So I've basically outed a future a future podcast, which is going to be about illnesses. But yes, women and work. So if anyone has any thoughts, anything you want us to read, anything you want us to think about, any issues that you want us to think about, then get in touch. We're on Twitter, we're on Facebook. The easiest thing for us to find us on Twitter is probably the podcast's own Twitter account, which is TNKPod. I always get the acronym wrong, but yes, Tomorrow Never Knows is TNKPod. And from there you can find our individual accounts as well. So just let us know. And goodbye for now.
Bye.